So Tesla had their Q3 earnings last week. They shared a lot of really important nuggets around their direction, what they're doing with self-driving technology. But there was one very specific nugget that we got from that call. And we have Tasha and Daniel from ARK Invest joining us today to discuss those. So Tasha, what's the thing that really grabbed your attention?
So what we paid most attention to was the mention of, you know, actually launching a ride hail service. So, you know, as you both know, after we caught up after 1010, we were hoping for more details on that. But, you know, it kind of makes sense that they might have waited for an investor event to give a little bit more information. I also think like they could be strategically keeping more close to their chests now that they're close to launch. But, you know, essentially, they said that they've been testing a ride-hail service for the better part of a year, quote unquote, in California. So, you know, for all the sort of naysayers that thought, okay, they're like nowhere close to doing this, they haven't done anything yet, you know, this kind of proves that they at least have put a lot of effort into it and feel close. So I think they'll launch first with that, with safety drivers, as they said. You know, as unsupervised FSD comes out next year, seems like it's only a matter of time before they could take them out.
Yeah, I was shocked to hear it, to be honest, because the whole thing with us Tesla investors following the story for as long as we have is that we always expected some sort of like overpromise, underdeliver with the whole, you know, just self-driving in general with Tesla. And then it comes to fruition that, okay, we've actually been testing this for like a year, y'all. And maybe it shouldn't be a surprise given a lot of the advancements they've had with the technology. Like that's been the gut feel, I feel like, from the community is like, this has to be going somewhere because the step changes have been so giant and the capability increases have been so drastic and the endpoint seems clearer than ever. Something's got to be happening, right? And then it seems like them actually putting it to the test was the big revelation from all those advancements.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Like to me, you know, Tesla is so great at sharing information, especially as investors. We love it, and as analysts, as associates, you know, it's great because we just have more data to analyze the company. So it's like almost surprising, and I think kind of like refreshing that it's like, okay, this is something that they actually kept a secret for a while.
Yeah.
And again, I think that they're doing that like somewhat purposefully because, you know, they're getting a lot of copycats. Like we know all the Chinese players are copying what they're doing for FSD. So I thought that was in itself exciting that it's like, oh, I didn't know about this. And that, like a year is a long time.
Yeah. It's definitely counter to what Tesla has been doing for the last few years. Maybe we can call this a sandbag, right? Because like the last time I feel like Tesla did something like this was the Model Y. The Model Y was slated to come out, I don't know, like 12 months after when they showed it. Remember, they did a whole history of Tesla. And then the last minute was like, oh, here's the Model Y. Okay, bye. You know, and like they ended the event really quick. But then that car actually came 6 months ahead of time. And it ended up being the best-selling car in the world. And I think their thought process was for that specific model, we got to be careful not to Osborne. Because this thing is going to be so massive and we don't want to give anybody any clues that this is coming any sooner than it is. Because if it does, then our Model 3 production is going to go to hell and we're not going to have the cash flow to be able to fund. We're going to have to raise cash, all that stuff, right? All the complexities, which kind of also is like, okay, are they doing that with this compact car and it's really the robo-taxi, but they're not saying it's a compact car because it doesn't have steering wheel and pedal? Kind of thing, you know? So it's like they're showing the compact car, the Model 2, but they're saying, no, it's not this car. This car's for later. But all you have to do is slap a steering wheel and pedal, and then that's a new car. But they can get away with saying that's not the new car, right? So it's like, and that's kind of what I feel with the self-driving too. It's like they're closer than we think. They're closer than we think. And I don't know. But it's at the same time, it's like, what's the advantage they gain by keeping it secret? To your point, it's like competitive advantage. You don't have other people that can replicate it. But if they really had that AI advantage, would it really be that easy to replicate? Because you need all those chips and everything. So it's like, I'm not super familiar with the state of China when it comes to that. But
yeah. I feel like it's not, I think that you're correct that it's not easy to start an autonomous taxi service by any means. But what we've seen is that others have tried to replicate their strategy. So, in particular in China, Baidu's Apollo, you know, they've gone through like a number of iterations in terms of what sensor sets they, you know, they use LiDAR. The last time we spoke with their IR team, they told us that, no, actually, we're going after the end-to-end approach that Tesla has, you know, famously piloted. So, and they're definitely like by volume, the largest player in China that's actually like testing on roads right now, you know, because Tesla's not doing that quite yet. I think it's more just in terms of like, yeah, strategy, sort of like planning, like the method that they're using that we've seen others like take, you know, leaps out of their book.
Yeah. Which is like interesting too, because for how long has Tesla and Elon been on the train of like, all you need is cameras and end to end. All you need is, it's like, and you have this gigantic shift now, like the market's like realizing that. So what does that mean for Tesla's lead? So how many years have they spent building that foundation for that to actually work, you know? Crazy
exactly.
to think about.
Exactly. Yeah. And Daniel can testify when we spoke with them, is the you know, they literally had a Elon's biography behind them on the bookshelf. So it's like, you know, that bought in.
That's amazing.
And pointed that out to us. So I think I think they're paying attention.
Go for it, Daniel.
Yeah, no, I was just Tasha took the words from my mouth. Yeah, I think they are kind of paying a lot of attention. And just going back to the point that you mentioned on like the product reveal, it definitely seems like Tesla, it's learning from the past. You know, you had the Roadster that's still yet to be delivered, and then also the Cybertruck that came a couple of years after it was announced. And now we have a new product launching at the beginning of next year, and very little detail on it. And it looks like it's going to kind of hit the ground running. So it definitely seems like maybe they're learning from past product announcements with the forthcoming low-cost vehicle. And I know we've spoken internally about it. There seems to be a lot of confusion between differentiating the Cybercab and the next gen low-cost vehicle. But in my opinion, it seems like it'll be like a low-cost kind of stripped-down Model 3, Model Y with the steering wheel, and ultimately probably support their vehicle growth that Elon said on the call of the 20 to 30%.
Yeah. Hans, this is probably a good place for you to jump in, but because I know this is like a freaking... We had Sandy on last week, too, talking about this. It's like we've been trying to figure this out. It's so hard.
Well, I'm definitely in alignment with Daniel on this. I think that it'll be something that's halfway in between the Cybercab and the Model 3 and the Model Y, most likely, and at least one. You know, there's so much ambiguity in the specific statement and so many different ways that it can be interpreted, but I think that makes the absolute most sense to me, especially when you think about the supply chain constraints. Like, how do you ramp from 2 million vehicles a year in 2023 to at least having a million Cybercab capacity run rate at the end of 2026 and potentially more out of just one factory? Like, you've got to do something to get that supply chain kind of built up between here and there. And you know, if we, or sorry, yeah, 2 million in 2024, and then so 2025 we'll have probably exiting with close to a 3 million units a year run rate with whatever these vehicles are. And you know, that's quite a bit of growth over 2024, and then adding, you know, at least another million in 2026. So we're talking about having capacity at the end of 2026. It's essentially double the capacity that we have installed today. And, you know, that's just huge. And if you're going to do that, you've got to progress smoothly in stages. You've got to utilize all of your existing infrastructure wisely. And so that absolutely makes the most sense to me. I think the one thing that I'm reminded of in all of this is that we kind of knew that they had this system in place for this ride share, you know, internally for employees, but they were just so good at being quiet. Like, there was one little piece of information that they gave to us in one of the quarterly earnings reports. And then I remember, in fact, I think Tasha, it was on one of the conversations that we had that we looked at. There was an employee, Rosalie Nathans, I think, who posted on LinkedIn about being the person who was featured in that little clip and saying that she had to pinch herself, that she got to, you know, be part of that, and that they're, you know, this is a real network that they're using. But when you combine that with the fact that, you know, they have to do all sorts, like, we know that Tesla has in-house drivers that are doing validation of the latest builds of FSD, And so they're, you know, they are driving and they're paying these drivers anyways. So why not, if you're having drivers driving around, well, they should be giving employees rides. Like, that's obviously the most efficient use of resources and capital, and Tesla's all about efficiency. And so, like, all of the common sense things were there. All, like, we knew that they had the app ready to go a while back. We knew that all the pieces were in place. But yeah, just because they had been so hush hush about it, we mm-hmm. even though we knew it was there, like, it's like, okay, well, I don't know, maybe it's not, you know, then all the doubt creeps back in, or just forgetting about it, because, you know, we're inundated with all the new data that's coming in all the time. And yeah, I had forgotten about those pieces of information for the last few months, and then reminded, yep, those were, you know, those were signal in all the noise, and they've been just steadily plugging away at this for quite some time.
I think too, when they first came out, everyone was speculating they were just renders, but it seems now in hindsight they're actual app screenshots, which is a testament to how long they've been testing it. And yeah, I think as well on the like you mentioned, utilizing the existing infrastructure, that seems to be a huge play for this compact car, because the confusion stems around the Cybercab. They used the term next-gen platform, which was going to originally use the unboxed method. And then to your point, I think Elon came in at the beginning of the year and said, okay, we need to look at what's our existing capacity to produce cars. And it seems like that what the compact car is going to be. It's going to be using the existing lines in their gigafactories, and maybe not achieving as many cost savings as they originally planned, because it's not going to use the unboxed method, but definitely maximizing their resources before building out the subsequent gigafactories for the ultimate ramp up of the Cybercab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for Ridehail, you know, we've published research on this before, that it's like, well, even if they launch with safety drivers, essentially a human driven Ridehail service, because electric vehicles already have a third of the maintenance and operating costs of a gas powered car, you know, compared to the average Ridehail car on the road, like technically they actually could undercut prices a bit if they wanted to. So they're already like a very real competitor to Uber, especially given, you know, that they have the scale to put cars on the road coming out of inventory, you know, potentially customers signing their cars up. So I think that that's, you know, it's like today they compete, or when they launch, they compete with Uber. And then long term, when they take the driver out, it's like, well, Uber's not really competition anymore, because the market expands so much when you lower the price. And I think, yeah, to this like existing infrastructure, like footprint, from a manufacturing perspective, charging, even though it looks like, you know, they'll do some wireless charging, maybe build out specific ride-hail infrastructure in the future. Like at first when they launch, they could likely just kind of use what they have and make do.
And I think one of the things to think about is the fact that Tesla can account for the cost of a lot of the, you know, whether they want to account for the cost of the safety drivers, but as part of their FSD build out, because it all is data validation and it is kind of a transitory investment that, hey, we're, you know, as we're scaling the system up, you know, yes, we have this entire business that can help support that cost for now. And this is an investment in reducing the overall, you know, operating cost of this platform and the robotaxis overall. And that's just, you know, Uber doesn't have, well, they do have, you know, a large business. They can't assign the cost that way, and they don't have a good path to getting those operational costs down and the unit economics right over time. And that obviously puts Tesla at a huge advantage. And I think one of the reasons that we have seen part of this shift in strategy from Elon in the build out of capacity for vehicles is because I don't think he necessarily expected to have to make the sizes of investments that they have made in their training compute. That building out Cortex in Austin is, you know, not a cheap endeavor. And I think that they prioritized all of the, you know, infrastructure around getting the brain for both FSD and the bot ahead of building out capacity to then give those brains the physical embodiment that they needed. And because, you know, if we go back in time a little bit, their focus was on trying to get Dojo to the point where it could be that brain, and it hasn't progressed quickly enough to do that, which meant that they had to go the third-party vendor route, which is much more expensive than if they had been able to, you know, do all of that training with in-house Dojo compute, which would have been a lot more, you know, it's more infrastructure, but it's also more energy. The NVIDIA chips are not going to be as efficient at doing that video training as if as Dojo would have been if it had been capable of doing what it was that they wanted to do. And so all of that just meant that there was money that they didn't really intend to spend on CapEx outside, or they intended to spend it on capacity and physical infrastructure for building out vehicles and robots. But they had to kind of switch some things around in the overall timing and make, yeah, a little bit more investment in things that they thought were going to go hopefully a different direction.
Yeah, something interesting that Kathy and I learned at the 1010 event too is that you don't build out training capacity unless you can like immediately use it. You know, they were talking about how they shared some chips with xAI. You know, they mentioned on the call in the investor letter that the capacity that they at least plan to get up and running happened like sooner than expected. And of course, they have more planned. So I think, you know, could be reading into it too much, but one way to look at that is like they are so ready to receive it that they're actually making an effort to speed it up, meaning that they're like confident in the software progress that they're seeing for FSD in terms of like, you know, the path to going unsupervised. So I think that's really interesting. Yeah, and one point that I'd love to make on Uber, because I feel like this is so heavily debated, and so, you know, I hear comments from Uber execs all the time about kind of their thoughts on the autonomous space. I think they're really disadvantaged here because you have to partner with a technology player. The technology player in terms of autonomy is the company that's actually able to bring the cost down. So it's like longer term, who do you think holds kind of like the cards and kind of the power and their relationship if Uber is really just supplying the platform? And Uber today, it's like their assets are really their drivers, and that's going away. And even I was thinking about this, like even from like a network optimization perspective, first of all, like I don't think it's trivial to launch a ride-hail platform and do routing appropriately and like please your customers. I don't think that's trivial. I just think it's an easier problem to solve than solving for full autonomy. And actually in an autonomous platform and what Tesla plans to do, like you have so much more control over your fleet because it's not people. I mean, sure, you have customers supplementing demand with their own vehicles, but you decide how many cars you want in a city. It's not like based on driver signups, right? So I do think there's actually like even more optimization that they can kind of squeeze out of ride hail that we're just not seeing today.
Yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
On the routing optimization too, I mean, they do it today with superchargers. When you click to go to a supercharger, you can see how many vehicles are on the way, how many there'll be when they're there. So there's definitely capabilities they can leverage Tesla that they use today.
Yeah, I've long been on the train that Uber's dead. I just don't understand the value proposition. And like let's role play this, right? Let's say Uber does become a place where you can offer self-driving vehicles. Let's say, right? It's going to be on the same network as the places where people have cars, like drivable vehicles, right? Whatever we want to call them, manual vehicles, okay? So what is that going to do? That's going to artificially inflate the price of the self-driving vehicle to match the market demand for whatever that is, right? So like you're introducing lower cost pieces into this network, but you're still going to sell it at whatever the market is demanding. And so if there's not another player out there that's doing a purely self-driving, you're still going to be okay. You're just going to increase your profit margin, right? But as soon as you introduce a player that has the whole stack, you know, it has the manufacturing, it has the app, it has the self-driving technology, and it just requires Tesla saying, we are going to go to market with this, automatically, they're going to be the cheaper product, automatically. And they're going to have the same profit margins, if not better than Uber. So at that point, why would anybody choose Uber over Tesla? It makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. And not only that, Tesla, to the point of the conversation, they have all the data. They can gather all the data from those learnings. Like Uber is not really going to have access to that proprietary data. Tesla's going to have access to that proprietary data. And so like, why would Tesla go through the pain of creating a ride hailing app and testing the ride hailing service if they're not trying to go to market with a ride hailing service, right? It's like, it to me, it doesn't, Uber in this world, like the only way they make sense is if they just turn into a fleet provider. Like literally, they just buy Tesla cars and then they put it on Tesla's network and then they just manage the fleet, you know?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, you know, they just announced that, because that's not really their business model now, owning and maintaining the cars, but they said that they're going to do that with Waymo. So it's like, oh, are you considering that transition? And yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And I think the fact that Waymo feels like they need to partner with them, and, you know, let's like argue on the other end, like maybe it's a Trojan horse. Maybe they're just kind of learning about the network and then they're going to say, yeah, no, thanks. We're going to keep our own platform here. But I think the fact that they're doing it kind of is like, you know, showing that the scale that they have is hard to actually please customers in the cities that they're operating in. So they need that support from Uber. So no, I totally agree about Uber's future, but I think that that's not like the typical, I see all the time. I even, you know, you saw after the event, like Uber stock went up. So I don't think that that's like the popular opinion. So I think like the only way that Uber does well in this scenario is like, which I, you know, I don't think this will happen, but if Tesla totally fails and there's like no scaled player, and then you're stuck with, you know, Waymo or let's say like other Waymo-like companies that just don't have the scale and need Uber in the short term. But even then, longer term, I feel like, again, who gets the majority of the economics when the autonomous tech is actually lowering that price?
Scale, go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, scale is an important point that Tesla is making too, even as part of that announcement with Waymo in Atlanta. They intend on scaling it to hundreds of vehicles. And this is something I think Elon alluded to on the call. They're producing 35,000 vehicles per week. So it's very difficult to catch up on that. And that said, granted, I mean, Waymo is operating today as an autonomous robo taxi provider, and they are making progress on their miles. I think last week they put out they've passed 25 million miles on their rider-only service. So it's not trivial. But in the grand scheme of things, it's small relative to Tesla. I think Waymo implies like 100,000 miles per week relative to full self-driving, which we estimate is around 5 million per day.
And that's per day, right?
Per day, yes. Per day. 100,000 Waymo per day versus Tesla 5 million per day. So a lot of catching up to do on the data front.
Yeah. And it's like, and with the news on the call too, that Hardware 3, which I thought was a huge one, where they said if Hardware 3 like doesn't reach full autonomy, we'll just replace the computer for free. And it's like, well, obviously you would, because that car is going to generate hundreds of thousands of dollars. Obviously you would, right? So like that what does that imply? Tesla already has millions of vehicles in their fleet.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they give up that advantage?
Yeah. I know we talked about that last time as well, the Hardware
3. We're fanboying. Let's go. I'm kidding. Go for it.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, it does seem like, you know, they are reserving that optionality. It makes sense that it's easier to launch on Hardware 4 first. And yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like they have, you know, I think it's like 6 million cars, or he said 6 to 7 million cars globally, Hardware 3 and Hardware 4. It's, you know, it's going to go more towards Hardware 4 over time, but let's just like say they're roughly 50-50 split, maybe 60-40. So they have a lot of incentive to make those vehicles work for this platform, because it's, you know, it is already like 2 to 3 million cars.
100%. So let me ask this question. I know you sort of alluded to this, Tasha, but I really want to understand how you're thinking about this and the rest of the panel, obviously. But so when we're talking about safety drivers, okay, let's try to like role play how this thing actually starts rolling out, this Tesla network, this driverless network with safety drivers to start, let's say. Are those safety drivers Tesla employees, or are they also customers that they can add to the program, right? And they just kind of like market it as an Uber competitor. It's like, hey, if you're a Tesla owner, you will now be able to be a Tesla driver, or you can start adding your car to the fleet. But for the first year or two, we're going to need you in the steering wheel and pedals, and make sure that you're controlling the car. But you're going to earn the same as an Uber driver, right? And once we're ready to roll out the driverless network, you'll still make the same or close to the same amount of money, let's say, but you no longer have to drive. And so it kind of like creates this sort of like expectation for the Tesla owners to start adding their car to the fleet. They start being there first. They kind of, you know, get an understanding of what it's really like to be a Tesla driver. It might bring, if you can be competitive and say, hey, if you're a Tesla owner and you're doing Uber on Uber, just come to us because we're going to be able to pay you more or the same. And we'll give you extra perks. If you turn on self-driving, we'll give you credits. We'll give you, we'll give you store credits. We'll give you supercharger credits, right? Like they can start pulling all these levers to start adding drivers to their fleet. Because we already know a ton of Uber drivers are driving Model 3s and Model Ys, right? So very curious to hear y'all's thought on that. Is that, how do you see that playing out?
Yeah, it's actually a really good point. We haven't discussed that internally specifically, but I do think that, okay, so I think there's like kind of a few different things. I mean, they do have their own fleet of drivers. I still think because they reiterated on the earnings call that it's actually quite difficult to find, they have a lot of data, but then finding the right data to train the fleet is hard. And that's, you know, one of the original reasons they're using these professionals. Like we all heard that story about like coming to the 100% complete stop of the stop sign. No one does that, but you can get a professional driver to do that. So I do still think that they will want kind of like a portion of those drivers to do that type of work. So maybe they're doing ride hail where they're doing it, maybe not. I think it's a really good point about, owners in like the human driven ride hail days, being able to supplement the fleet. And that is like actually a key going back to like Tesla versus competition. That's like a key, advantage that Tesla can have over anyone else that tries to do this. But I would say that I have a feeling they're also going to want like their own fleet of, or, you know, their own group of test drivers, because I mean, the way that the other autonomy players have done this is like that person is, a test driver, but they're also like part engineer and they're meticulously documenting everything that they notice that is off. And you want someone with a really good understanding of the system to do that. So I think it's like you're making a really great point about just getting to scale, which is necessary in order to, again, just make the base level of service something that is competitive with what already exists in ride hail. But I feel like they're probably going to want, again, like that dedicated set of professionals that understands the back end of like the software stack that can feed information to the FSD team to improve it.
Yeah, the way that I think about that is that those professional, you know, Tesla employee drivers who are going to be those, you know, like the ones that they already have now that are doing the safety driver position, that they're essentially the FSD ride hailing equivalent of the auto labeling team for, you know, FSD in general, and that they'll start out being a larger group of people. You know, they'll have to ramp it up, they'll have to develop the program, there'll be quite a few people, but that over time, I actually think I agree with Farzad that they'll transition, and either that group of people will stay at a fixed size and then they'll continue to scale with those owners, or it could be that over time they actually then scale back and they reduce the size of that in-house team of safety drivers as they're able to complete all of their objectives and get the autonomous ride-hailing network really off the ground and completely pushed out to primarily external people. Unless they decide that, you know, there are just areas where we do want to have, you know, it's always difficult to forecast exactly how handling peak demand in the major urban areas is going to work, and if there's going to have to be some sort of hybrid solution where there are, you know, Tesla owned vehicles that are part of handling peak demand and then supplemented by customer owned vehicles, or if that can just be completely handled by a marketplace that pays, you know, owners of the vehicles, and Tesla doesn't actually own any of those. But yeah, I think that some sort of both scenario is what I view as most likely overall, that it's not going to be, you know, all Tesla drivers or all customer owned vehicles, that it's going to be some combination of the two.
Yeah, you could imagine that there's also like a liability consideration here. If you're trying to prove to regulators that it's safe, you want to have a lot of control over what that fleet that is dedicated to ride hail does. So yeah, maybe at first they like err on the side of caution with their own kind of trusted people, and then they open it up. That's a possibility.
It seems like too, that's how they've approached the sequential versions of full self-driving. It first goes to employee testing, and then it goes to kind of a solid core group of retail investors or the public, and then it goes to a broader release. So it could be maybe that could be indicative of a method of rolling out ride hail with safety drivers. I think too, you shouldn't understate how valuable the retail base is for Tesla. There's so many enthusiastic investors who are willing to drive full self-driving and not get paid for it, and myself included. And I'm sure they'd grasp the opportunity to to do that and get paid and offer Lyft too. And you can even see on videos on X, people even use full self-driving today, doing it through the Uber app. So,
yeah, I think what's interesting about this discussion is, like, as I'm thinking through it, I'm trying to put myself in like the shoes of Tesla. Is like this is like the beauty of having your own network, is that you can pull so many levers to create the incentive that you want, right? And so what's one example of doing that? So like literally sell this as an Uber, like just literally just say Tesla has launched an Uber competitor. Don't even say it's driverless, right? And it says if the larger share of your drive that is self-driving, the larger cut of the profit you take. Because the less you use self-driving, the more we have to account for potential injury. Because we have data that says that if you're driving, right, we need to make sure that we're setting aside money to cover the expenses from accidents happening, so on and so forth, right? And so you can start to say, like, hey, if you come on our network and you buy a Tesla and you put on self-driving, if you go 95% plus, you get 100% of the profit. If you go 50% of the drive with self-driving, you get 70% of the profit, whatever that number is. And then you create an incentive for your drivers to use self-driving. And then when you put them in positions to actually do ride hailing, you're automatically collecting the data that you need to collect. And in addition to having that small set of professional drivers that are really going after those exceptions, and I'm wondering how much creating that sort of Uber competitor, direct competitor, vastly increases the amount of exceptions you're looking for, because that is the market you're trying to serve, right? Like just going around town, constantly driving around town, picking up people, dropping them off. Only Uber drivers do that, right? Like you and I, just we do our usual route. We know where we're going 90% of the time. We're probably driving over time worse, like how we should be driving, because we know there's not going to be a cop here. I know when this light's going to turn red. I know that this stop sign here, like whatever, it's like everyone rolls through it, right? But if you're constantly introducing even non-professional drivers to new situations, I feel like drivers default to a safer and safer standard, which becomes a very valuable place for Tesla to collect the data. Just like thinking out loud, it's like one of those things, like Tesla can do that. Theoretically, Tesla could do that, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they can already likely see like which cars are ride-hailing cars on in their network today, even on Uber. I mean, and we know that they get, as long as, like, depending True. On consents, et cetera, but they get like some data from every vehicle on the road, and they can get camera data. Of course, like for accidents, they can see any of that. So there's, it's like, I wonder exactly like how many Teslas are already ride hail cars that they have information from. But the incentive piece is interesting. I mean, and it's like, even from the consumer perspective, like we had asked them in the past, okay, like, because at first when FSD rolled out, you were incentivized to be a really safe driver in order to get it. And then they didn't, they allowed it to, roll out to the average consumer, and they sort of never went back to that incentive scheme. And it suggests that they didn't really have to. Maybe they just like have enough data now that they don't. But yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think one other point that I like to make is that, like in our model, when we model the price per mile that an autonomous taxi could charge, the utilization rate, so how often the car drives, like the actual revenue miles that you get off of that vehicle, is perhaps like one of the most sensitive levers in terms of the price. Like it really meaningfully changes price if you ramp that up or down. And so the reason it's such an advantage that they can have customer cars supplement the network is because if you think of like the optimal fleet that you need to meet peak demand, it's obviously not the same size as, what the average is, right? So if you were to actually own all of those vehicles, that each the peak demand vehicles that you need, that you don't need for the, you know, every day, or let's say like average hour in the day driving, are actually a lot more expensive than like the base load vehicles that you need, because they don't, they're not going to get the same utilization rate. This is like part of the research that we're doing, is we're, you know, working on our big ideas deck that'll come out in the beginning of the year. But I think it's a really interesting point.
I think I told you, Hans, here, I just want to get this out of my brain. So like in that world, right, Tesla could just, let's say there's somebody that doesn't want that is like, I'm not going to add my Tesla to the network. That's crazy. I don't want people puking on it. Right. But then there's like, I don't know, like this past weekend, ACL, Trump is going on Rogan. You got the F1 race. You got Texas versus Georgia. Austin was a shit show. Like that airport almost crumbled. Right. So the amount of people that are here is insane. Friday night, somebody who's almost never going to add their car. Hey, if you add your car to the fleet, you'll make $500 an hour. Maybe I should add it to the fleet. Right.
Yeah.
Tesla has that capability. Go ahead, Hans.
Yeah, the one thing on the incentives that I would say is, you know, they don't necessarily need FSD to be on in order to collect data from that car, because FSD is almost certainly running in shadow mode already, and they can query the entire fleet for any piece of data that they need to improve their training data set, and all that stuff is kind of figured out. But it is different when FSD is actually on versus not on, as far as, you know, what are the situations that FSD is going to get itself into? And then once it gets itself into a sticky situation, you know, how does it handle that compared to, well, the driver would have made a different decision 5 seconds ago, and we never would have even encountered this specific piece of information. So there's some truth to what you're saying, Farzad, but, you know, I just wanted to add a little bit of nuance and context to it. The other thing that I wanted to mention in relation to what Tasha was saying was when they did the incentive program, you know, for safety scores, I always think about their exposure to risk overall. Like, I think that the reason that they had the safety score at first was basically just a way that the demand to experience FSD was greater than the capacity of the system to operate safely. And it would have exposed them to more risk of incidents than they were ready to expose the system to at that point in time. And so they needed, you know, they were using price already as one filter to keep people out of the FSD beta program. And then they were using safety score as the other thing to keep people out. And that the quality of the software has progressed to the point now where they don't need to keep people out of it as much. In fact, now that we've got the free trials going on, they're roughly happy with the number of beta users. And I think that the metric that determines how many people that they want to expose the system to is a risk-based system that's entirely based on safety. It has nothing to do with revenue. It has nothing to do with even, you know, data gathering or all of the things that they need to actually solve the problem technically. I think that it is an overall safety risk exposure metric that says, okay, hey, you know, we can have now billions of miles worth of actual driving a year, and we don't think that we're going to be in a situation where we're going to have that news story that pops where FSD got into a terrible wreck and killed a whole bunch of people and derails the whole program.
So go ahead, Tasha, did you want to?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, absolutely. You know, they want to keep customer safety in mind. It's just interesting because clearly the kind of like the right data is so important to them that they chose to like in-house that, you know, that driver function a little bit versus like incentivizing the consumer to do it for them. You know what I mean? But I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Okay. So timeline, right? It's always like a guessing game. It's like a futile attempt to try to figure out timeline with this shit, but let's try. What did the Q3 earnings call change anything for y'all when it comes to thinking about speed of rollout, size of rollout, timing of rollout, jurisdiction approvals, regulation approvals, Tesla strategy? And we can start with like the timing, right? So did the Q3 earnings call change anything from a timing perspective for y'all on when you expect Tesla to start monetizing this program? And then we'll start with Tasha.
All right, Daniel, do you want to share sort of our probability weighted previous estimate?
So our model is open sourced. It's on our website, available for download. And it's a 5,000 simulation. It's a Monte Carlo simulation. So it's a distribution of when we think it will launch. And in our model that we published in June, the most probable year we had was 2025, call it 60%, and then 40% in 2026. So it's roughly aligned with that. And that's the initial start to a robotaxi adoption. And then it grows in line with our adoption curve, which is various different inputs and resources behind it. But yeah, I would say it's roughly in line with our expectation, but granted it's Elon timeline, so maybe take it with a pinch of salt, as history would suggest. But it definitely, like I think Tasha said at the beginning of the call, the fact that it's explicitly called out as a ride-hail service starting in 2025 was extremely interesting to us. It was no longer, we're going unsupervised next year, and it's really the launch of a new business model. And I know, Tasha, you've done a lot of work on the sizing of that, and we included it in a newsletter we put out this week.
Yeah, I think it gave us more confidence in that estimate that we had, you know, the 60-40, 2025, 2026. I definitely think now that we know that they've been testing ride-hail for a year roughly, that it makes the 2025 launch more probable. It seems like kind of for the first time that it's okay, like they're very confident. The technology part, again, I still think is the hardest part of the puzzle in terms of, well, you just need to, in order to get the car to a point where it drives itself, that's still very difficult and they haven't done that yet. But regulation is just becoming much more of a factor now that they're just so close to that launch. So some of it, of course, depends on what are regulators looking for. I mean, they mentioned miles, but interestingly, they also said time. Like those are two very different things. Like they could rack up miles easily because they have a fleet that they can, as we've been talking about, like they control to a large extent, and they're a manufacturer themselves. But if there's like a time, you know, that regulator said is okay, well, we just need 6 months no matter what. Then that sort of changes that launch introduction date. And they really stand alone as a player that is like, can work on those two avenues, because for Waymo, again, the fleet size is just so much smaller. It's like, maybe that's one and the same for them, miles and time, but for Tesla, it's not. So I do think that a lot of it will come down to that. And as we know in California, where they first started, which makes a lot of sense, the cars work well there. That's where we're seeing some of the most impressive FSD videos, come out of. But they have some of the strictest regulations for autonomy and many hoops to jump through. It's like, okay, well, first safety drivers, and then there's certain permits that you need to even charge customers for it versus not charge. It's not an easy task. I think it's easier than making a car drive itself, but we'll see how that plays out. What do you all think?
I think that the most interesting piece of the regulation, because you know, I think I'm on the boat of the technology will get there way faster than the regulation will get there. One of the very interesting things about this year specifically is Elon's involvement in politics and trying to pick a side of who's going to win. I think what's interesting there is in a Trump victory, I wonder if his ability to influence change and speed of regulatory approval is actually significant. Whereas it under Harris win, I wonder if, you know, I'm not going to say they're going to stonewall him, but what I'm curious is, like, will the Trump admin somehow speed up the process, right? Because you would have to think is, like, you know, business people partner with politicians, they gain a little bit of favor, they kind of help you move stuff along a little bit in our system, right or wrong, that's just the truth. So, like, that's one variable that I'm going through, is I do think whoever wins might have a little bit of influence on the approval process. At some point, it's going to become, like, the forcing function of the economic benefit of having a self-driving platform in your city is going to be so vast that it's going to be hard to ignore. But I do think that in this case, I do think a Trump victory will speed up that process a little bit. It's hard to quantify, but it's hard to ignore. That's how I view it. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, I agree. You're making this point, which is, well, no matter the outcome, autonomous cars are safer than human-driven cars. Yep. Certainly the data that we're getting from Waymo suggests that. Tesla's FSD data suggests that it's safer to use than a human-driven Tesla. We've estimated roughly 5 times safer based on the last stat that they published. So I think it'll happen no matter what. I think the, you know, he was angling on the earnings call for a, for this to be decided at the federal level versus the state level, which would make for a much easier rollout potentially. So that maybe that's kind of one of the discussion points that he's having with, you know, potential future leaders here.
For sure. Hans or Daniel?
I think as well, it's definitely a driving function from an economic perspective too. Last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, Palo Alto said that they were in talks with Tesla to bring the potential cyber cab there. And I think they have their own Link service that's having financial difficulty and it's kind of borderline on running out of finances. But yeah, I do think to Tasha's point and both yours, Farzad, that the economic perspective shouldn't be overlooked because really that's the most important point and it's pretty big driving function to get people into cities. Even I know people who travel to LA and San Francisco, the first thing they do is look and try and get into a Waymo car and post it everywhere on social media and say, look, I'm in a driverless car. So I think that's a maybe a marginal point, but shouldn't be overlooked.
Yeah, and Uber does that today. I mean, certain cities have decided to use Uber like ride hail vehicles over doing some kind of like public effort to get you know, like a bus system or something up and running. Sometimes it's already cheaper, so.
Yeah, I think that you know, Palo Alto is a good example right now, but I think that will be a growing concern, especially as municipalities really struggle financially with a lot of the strains that are being put on cities right now for, you know, various reasons, that transportation is an area that, hey, if we can achieve massive save, like they're going to be looking for areas to save money. And we already know that, you know, a lot of public services, whether it's, you know, the police departments or, you know, all kinds of municipal services are really being stretched thin right now or having, you know, budgetary restraints imposed on them and having to make cuts. And so if we can, hey, we can provide better transportation services at lower costs and people are going to be happier, like that's the type of political win-win-win situation that will make those decisions become super fast, super streamlined, super easy. And where, you know, in a normal environment, all that licensing bureaucracy would get in the way. Like at some point, if the politicians can find a way to make their constituents happy, and especially after, you know, the first few cities do it and no one has to be the trailblazer, they can just, we're going to adopt the policy from this place over here. It's already been shown to work. Like it'll, I think the dominoes will fall very quickly.
I think that's a very interesting point. The lens that I love to view that through is like half the country's paycheck to paycheck, maybe more, right? In the United States, people can barely pay their bills. They can't save anything. And owning a car, paying for gas, paying for maintenance, paying for insurance is usually like 20 to 50% of their paycheck, okay? To try to get to work. What's very interesting is that autonomous vehicles, like cheap, scalable autonomous vehicles, which I believe Tesla is the only one really right now that has the ability to do that. Those are going to, like, it almost like they're going to congregate in the places that would need it the most, which are like your non-standard areas where you think of like high tech rollout. It's not your San Francisco, your New York. It's like your cities that are struggling in Appalachia, in the Northeast, in the South, in the Midwest, like places that need a little, like that friction removed from going to from point A to point B so that people can actually make a decent living and so they don't have to pay half their paycheck for a freaking car that breaks down every 3 months anyway. That is the beauty of this technology. And I think that's so overlooked. You know, it's like people are worried about the safety piece, like that's already taken care of. And I think ultimately the forcing function is going to be, I'm struggling to pay my bills and this thing's going to allow me to pay my bills. And that's going to create the adoption more than anything, is my prediction. I don't know.
Yeah, Uber, there was some studies that were done in New York that suggested that it actually made the biggest difference in the outer boroughs because that's where you couldn't hail a cab before. It just wasn't as, you know, cost effective for the drivers to hang out there. They'd hang out in the most dense areas of the city. So I do think that autonomous ride hail, both, you know, with lower prices, can encourage kind of could potentially encourage ride hail to spread out to areas where it's just not economic to operate it today. So I totally, and to, you know, we're talking so much about Tesla, but to broaden it out for 1 second, autonomous technology actually, I think, will make this difference in general, particularly things like drone delivery. You know, that also you could imagine makes a much bigger difference in areas where you don't have like the delivery options that I have here at my fingertips in New York City. Again, because you make the case sort of more economic in areas where it wouldn't make sense before to launch a full scale service. So I think that's a trend in general with this type of robotics technology.
The amount of deflation that we're going to experience in the coming years is nuts. Like it really does feel so incredibly deflationary, and the technology is there. We just got to like nip and tuck and get the regulators to be like, go. And then all of a sudden you're going to have all these areas that like historically have been just beaten down. That can finally have something that helps them like feel like they can breathe, and it will feel modern. It will feel new. I think that's powerful. To very just across the whole, and I know like now we're getting very broad, but like ultimately that's why these technologies win. Like if you really go across like the history of technology, the reason why technologies win is because they make your life better and it's way cheaper. Like autonomous vehicles do that. These drone delivery services do that, right? Artificial intelligence, period. ChatGPT. Like Hans and I and David, our editor guy in the background, I can't tell you how insane of a difference AI has made in our workflow. It's insane. And it's just getting started, right? It's like, just snowball this. And like, who are the companies that have figured this out? Feels like a handful that are at least trying to, that have come up with a profitable use case that's actually going to have a vast impact. And of course, that those number of companies will increase over time. But yeah, this is what makes it so exciting. It's just, it feels so positive and so game changing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about that all the time, how technology creates positive deflation. And, you know, we estimate even for autonomous cars alone that there could be, you know, roughly $30 trillion, say like $20 to $30 trillion impact on GDP globally. Because it's okay, well, sure, you're reducing the cost per mile, that's expanding the market, but also you're reducing accidents. And from, you know, a very cut and dry look, you're actually keeping people alive that are contributing members of society. You know, in general, you're giving people back time that, sure, you could potentially work in the, you know, the backseat of the car. But if planes are like any indication of how people spend their time, maybe you're just consuming, right? So, but you're contributing like some dollars to the economy, either via subscription or what have you. Either way. I think that this will be one of the, you know, the largest AI projects in terms of impact that we've seen to date. And then we think humanoid robots after that will be, you know, as Elon says, potentially even a bigger opportunity. But autonomous cars we'll see first.
And I know y'all got to go, but it's like this, it's like, let me throw this in there. The fact that the autonomous vehicle piece will be cheaper than the current drive, like manual solution, and it's going to be more luxurious because you have privacy and you have entertainment, right? Those are just insane. Like the plane example is interesting because it's like, okay, so it's like, it'd be like a plane, right? Like you're maybe your behavior is going to mirror a plane, but the experience versus the plane is completely different, because in a plane, we're all like this, and we're like shoulder to shoulder. Somebody just farted behind you. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's just a disaster, right? Sorry for making a crew, but it's true. But like, but with a self-driving vehicle, it's privacy, right? You got a screen, you got nice speakers, you might have heated and cool seats, right? It just completely changes the dynamic of what it means to go from point A to point B. It's insane, man. Daniel, I'll give you the last word. I know I don't want you guys to get in trouble with Kathy. Go for it.
Yeah, no, I think Tasha touched on it all. I think the broader autonomous space is super exciting. You have autonomous vehicles, autonomous drones. There's also autonomous trucks. Some players are potentially going to go commercial by the end of this year. So I think it's all positive, promoting positive deflation. And yeah, we're kind of super excited to monitor all of the spaces, including Tesla. So yeah, great to be on today.
Where can people find you? And then we'll throw it to Tasha. Where can people find her?
I'm on X, formerly Twitter. The tag is @dmaguireark, and we publish all of our research, be it kind of weekly newsletters or updated on blogs every couple of weeks. And that's kind of where we post all of our Tesla related news too. So
awesome. Tasha, where can people find you?
You can also find me on X. Also, you know, everyone follow Daniel, very underappreciated account, in my opinion. He posts so many great things, but I'm Tasha Ark on X. At ark-invest.com, you can find all of our research, blogs. We also have a newsletter that we publish weekly. And we're coming out with our annual Big Ideas deck early next year. So look out for that.
Awesome. We'll have links for their handles and their research in the description and comment below. Section below, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye.
Bye.